This show is brought to you by 13 Turns, a new horror anthology by Kevin Carr. 13 jolting tales of terror, murder, and the macabre. Only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Greetings, couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, we're kicking off the summer movie season a couple months early with Batman v Superman, Dawn of Justice. I'm also going to be talking about My Big Fat Greek Wedding 2, and then a couple smaller films in limited release, Creative Control, the 17th Annual Animation Show of Shows, Embrace of the Serpent, and Baskin. Why spend all the time talking about Superman and Batman when there's some other stuff that's out there that's unique and different and offers an interesting counter-programming beyond just a romantic comedy? But first, before I talk about any of that, I'm going to be talking about the news, the trailer park, some box office predictions, and of course, the home cinema roundup. And if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm lurking around at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Some smaller pieces of news and maybe a little bit of Batman and Superman news here. First of all, let's talk about Ascendant, which is the sequel to Allegiant. Now, the original plan was to have these two-part movies and do like Harry Potter did or Twilight, where it made twice as much as you would have gotten. What happened in this is, and I'll talk about more of this when I talk about the box office, but Allegiant's opening numbers were really paltry. In fact, it only made about worldwide what its predecessors made domestically in its opening weekend. So these are heavily suppressed numbers. And that sort of sent Summit Entertainment into a tailspin, because not only do they have to make and distribute in Ascendant, but they've got this whole movie that they're on the hook for, and will the numbers even hold up for what they got for Allegiant? So the news has come out that they're going to cut the budget from Allegiant's, whatever it was, $110 million down a bit. I don't know, maybe it'll only be $50 or $60 million, which we'll see if that actually works. I mean, the first Divergent was like $85 million, and then the next two were $110, so the risk versus return isn't quite there. And speaking of movies that might be a little bit premature to get too excited about, Suicide Squad, which was given a PG-13 rating, is apparently going to retain that. A lot of people were questioning whether Warner Brothers was going to allow it to have an R rating, mainly because of the success of Deadpool. And I guess they're also going to see how Batman versus Superman does and whether that's going to warrant a riskier endeavor in August. But according to Warner Brothers right now, Suicide Squad will be retaining its PG-13 rating, which, you know, it could be good, it could be bad. Who knows what kind of a choice that is until it happens. And then finally, in a little bit of Batman versus Superman news, because that's the only thing people are talking about when it comes to movies this week, the embargo lifted on Tuesday night, which meant immediately all the critics that got a chance to see it ran home to Twitter and Facebook and started trashing it. And there's, I think it holds like a 30%-ish on Rotten Tomatoes right now, which is kind of BS anyways. But the reason you can't trust a tomato meter reading, even if it doesn't jive well with the audience rating, which tends to be much higher, the reason you can't trust those critic ratings is because there's a lot of people that I think were gunning for Zack Snyder. I think there's a lot of people that were frustrated and annoyed with his recent movies, and particularly in Man of Steel, which is a very polarizing film, as well as Sucker Punch, which was a real dud. You know, the days of Dawn of the Dead and 300 are over. Even the days of Watchmen are over for Zack Snyder, and I think people wanted to just stick it to Zack Snyder a little bit. I'm not defending him. We'll talk about the movie here in a second. But I think that this is almost a fact that the movie lived up to some of these critics' expectations. Now, that's not to say that they're getting paid to write good reviews or bad reviews, but oftentimes attitude does count. And the way to get noticed and the way to people to read your reviews and clickbaiting and getting people to read your reviews and getting those traffic numbers is becoming more and more important, because that's where your money comes from. And with the amount of ad blockers that are out there, it becomes even more important to push your review, and the best way to do it is to be as inflammatory as possible. I think there were people who were just waiting for this to fail. And so before it even was released, before even the public had a chance to see it, the critics kind of were going after it. And I think the production did it to itself. Warner Brothers is at fault at this as well, because they wanted this hype to last as much as possible. I mean, the hype for this movie is like 2 years long. And they've spent so much time hyping the movie that people, I think, just got a little annoyed with it. I mean, they had the trailer party release like a year ago. So that's where I think Batman versus Superman was a bit mishandled, overhandled, overmanaged in marketing. And we'll talk about the actual movie itself in a little bit. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to talk about is Now You See Me 2, which is, of course, the sequel to Now You See Me, the movie with the magicians, you know, with like Jesse Eisenberg and Mark Ruffalo was chasing them down, and Woody Harrelson was in it. This is the sequel that opens on June 10th.
You thought that they had disappeared forever. Ladies and gentlemen, the Four Horsemen.
Are you listening, horsemen? You will get what's coming to you.
Thank you, everybody!
In ways you can't expect.
Hey, it's great to be back.
Now the greatest magicians in the world are my magic trick.
You people are still going to play your little game.
I know you will.
First thing you'll notice in this movie, it does not have Ela Fisher in it, and that's kind of a shame because she's adorable and great, and I love seeing her in movies, but maybe she's spending more time at home. She might have to start working again now that her husband Sacha Baron Cohen's film, The Brothers Grimsby, did not do well. But she was replaced in terms of getting the one girl of the group back. You got Lizzie Kaplan, who I'm a huge fan of anyway, so... For me, it's kind of a wash. I like both of them, so I'm happy with either one. The one thing that does make me a little trepidatious about this movie is the fact that John Chu is directing it. And he did all the Step Up movies, and it feels like a Step Up trailer, only with magicians. John Chu is a bit of a one-note director. Even if he has success doing that, I don't think he's going to have the nuance that the original one did. And like magic shows... This one is actually appearing to be more flash than any sort of reality. What was the neat part about Now You See Me is when they finally pulled back the veil and revealed their trick, you're like, eh, well, it's a stretch, but I can still believe that that could happen. I'm not sure whether that's going to be the case with Now You See Me 2. The next one I want to talk about is Ben-Hur, not the original with Charlton Heston, but the new one with some guy I really don't recognize. And that opens on August 12th.
In the arena, there is no law. Racing is a blood sport. If you lose, you die. If your brother is the pride of Rome, defeat him and you'll defeat an empire. Then you will have your vengeance.
Should have stayed away.
You should have killed me.
I will.
Now, me watching this trailer, I was thinking pretty much what everyone else was thinking when I saw this. And that was, why? To me, remaking Ben-Hur is sort of like when Gus Van Sant tried to remake Psycho. Or he did remake Psycho back in the 90s. And it's like, oh yeah, he made it. He succeeded in putting together a movie. And I mean, I guess in a vacuum, it would have been a fine movie, but it was just such an unnecessary remake. And I feel the same way about Ben-Hur, and I think a lot of people feel that way. The original was such a classic, and it was such a big deal, and it left an indelible image on American cinemas. And for all of its foibles, it's a little bit cheesy, and it gets very whitewashed, because obviously you got Charlton Heston playing, you know, an Israeli prince. It still had a specialness to it. It had that epic feel. Nowadays, when you put all that effects that they have in there, it kind of just looks like every other crappy CGI sword and sandal biblical epic wannabe. I mean, it looks like it fits more into a category of Pompeii or Legend of Hercules or Gods of Egypt, which I actually kind of thought was fun, but is still kind of crappy. It's not the Ten Commandments. It's not the original Ben-Hur. I don't know. It also is coming out in August, which is not a very great time to be releasing what should have been the biggest movie of all time, the movie that the studio became known for. So I'm not expecting much from the Ben-Hur remake. That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm not going to be talking about Batman v Superman. I am going to be talking about My Big Fat Greek Wedding 2 and Creative Control. Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life. Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies. Let's launch into the movie reviews with the biggest movie of the weekend, and that is, of course, My Big Fat Greek Wedding 2. It's biggest because it has big in the title. I think it's actually technically shorter of a title than Batman v Superman Dawn of Justice. Every week I write emails to the people in radio when I'm doing call-ins, and I have to tell them, hey, these are the movies that are opening this week. I probably used more characters to tell the two movies that were opening wide this week than I do when there's three or four movies opening. It's like Batman v Superman's one and Dawn of Justice is a different one. But My Big Fat Greek Wedding 2 is, of course, the sequel to the 2002 mega hit. And now with a 17-year-old daughter annoyed with her own overbearing family, Tula has to deal with another Big Fat Greek Wedding when her parents discover their marriage wasn't official.
Sam was always in my business.
Keep your eyeballs open for a nice Greek boy so one day you can make babies.
They follow me everywhere. I need some air.
Your mom felt the same way about being Greek.
Florida, Texas, New York. These are the colleges I'm applying to. Why do you want to leave me?
Payback. The priest never signed a wedding license.
I'm a hippie.
Who says a woman has to be married?
You. All our lives.
What's funny about this series, and we can call it a franchise or a series because there was, if you forget, there was like this very short-lived television series, My Big Fat Greek Life, which starred her and it had everyone else in it except for John Corbett. He didn't star in the TV show, but it was the continuation of the story. I think that was just a little too close to the movie's release. It felt unnecessary and very one-note. As Belloc likes to say in Raiders of the Lost Ark, buried in the sand for 1,000 years and it'll become priceless. You know, you bury this movie on DVD shelves and then you come back with a sequel. And what could have gotten very tired on television with The Big Fat Greek Life, it's sort of charming again. Now, I am not a huge fan of Nia Vardalos. She had a one-woman show that she stuck to her guns to do, lucked into Tom Hanks and Rita Wilson producing a movie based on it, and having it become a mega super hit. While that panned out for her there, it didn't pan out anywhere else in her career. If you look at everything else she has been involved in, or even touched, it's a failure. I mean, there's been, maybe some have made their money back, but if you look at like Connie and Carlo, that was her big follow-up to My Big Fat Greek Wedding, and that thing was awful, and it bombed. I mean, hard. And then she did, obviously, My Big Fat Greek Life, which got canceled in like 6 episodes. And then she had a string of movies, I don't know, 5, 6 years ago. I Hate Valentine's Day, which I think she directed. She had My Life in Ruins, which she starred in, but again, it was that whole sort of experience in her Greek roots. And she wrote Larry Crown, which Tom Hanks directed. And it did well enough to make its money back, but I think that was only because Tom Hanks and Julia Roberts were starring in it. But she hasn't been in anything. I mean, she's done nothing of any serious note. Quite literally, her husband, Ian Gomez, is more famous than her post Big Fat Greek Wedding because at least he was doing stuff like Cougar Town. He had regular work. So I was not looking forward to this one. I remember seeing the trailers for it and thinking, oh my God, this is going to be terrible. And you can tell it's her baby. So she's trying not to be egotistical and she's not trying not to be, spotlighting herself, but also not trying to, it's just kind of awkward when it's about her. When it's about the rest of the family, it's actually very charming. I was surprised that I found the movie likable. And what makes the movie work is all the quirky weirdness of her Greek family, which they have everyone back. You know, even the really old ones and the young ones too. I mean, Joey Fatone is getting a little bit gray, But, you know, it's neat to see everybody back, and they all kind of fit in the roles really well. Andrea Martin does the best. She's the best part of the movie, actually. She's hilarious. And this is still an unrequested sequel. It does seem very forced at times. She has several storylines she's trying to juggle. Ironically, at the time when Batman v Superman is coming out, which is being criticized for having way too many stories and people and characters in it to juggle, My Big Fat Greek Wedding 2 does a worse job getting all that to work. You know, they have the story about her daughter, and so that was, that's, you got to deal with that. And then they got the story about her parents, and then they got the other side stories. It's almost like she didn't have an idea for a full movie. Whereas, like, My Big Fat Greek Wedding, the first one, is her story, and that's what it's about. And anything that's not about her can be cut. But that gave them a full movie. And this one, I think if they just stuck to the daughter or stuck to her parents, they wouldn't have had a full movie. So it's unnecessary, and it's not as even or fresh or as good as the original, but it still is pretty decent, I have to admit. I will fully admit that I was wrong about my first impressions from the trailer. My Big Fat Greek Wedding 2 actually kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Creative Control. This is a much smaller movie. It's an independent film. In the not-too-distant future, a tech marketing team deals with the possibilities and limitation of life behind a wearable interface technology.
I had a vision that we could enhance real life with a magical lair in front of it. So this is our approach. We give a pair to a genius. We see what comes back. Might have a new art form on her hands.
Magic is what Augmenta is.
Welcome, David.
It'd be weird when we all have chips in our brain.
It won't seem weird then. It'll seem inevitable.
I think this was obviously inspired by Google Glass, which has been discontinued, because if you ever knew somebody or saw somebody with Google Glass, it was so obvious that they had Google Glass. It was such a status symbol, and the people had sort of a reputation of being smug jerks. This takes it to a little less noticeable perspective, where the wearable technology, which is essentially Google Glass, I mean, it's, you have glasses, but it just looks, you have glasses. It doesn't have that weird sci-fi look to them. And you can be more stealth about it. And this does juggle around some ideas of privacy and intimacy and social media and interacting with each other through technology, which obviously is getting more and more prevalent with Twitter and Facebook, or even something like Skype that allows you to just interact with people without physically being there with them. I mean, my son has a new girlfriend now. He's 12 and he's got a girlfriend, and they are constantly on Skype together, which is hysterical because it's the modern version of when I was a kid, and the kid would be on the phone all the time with his girlfriend. I mean, I walk in the room and he's got his computer up and they're talking on Skype. He's going outside and he's hanging out with his brother, just enjoying the nice weather. And he's got his little smartphone there with Skype up. So they're constantly in contact. So I think this is trying to make some greater statement about that. The problem is, it ultimately is just about a jerk who's wanting to have an affair with this other girl. And it's this really angsty, painful, uninspired, unoriginal non-romance, because the guy is infatuated with his girl, and this gear that he wears sort of allows him to make it a little more realistic without being as overt in real life. But ultimately, it's just a crummy little story about a guy who wants to cheat on his girlfriend. And that's, I think, where it fell apart. I didn't like any of the characters. I didn't even like the ones that were, you should be sympathetic for, like the girlfriend he's cheating on. I just didn't like anybody in it. It has some neat effects and it has some neat ideas, but it ends up circling the drain as some modern version of a French New Wave Bohemians in Love kind of movie. I talked about one a couple weeks ago called In the Shadow of Women. It feels like a sci-fi modern day tech version of that, which I'm not a fan of anyway. So I'm going to have to say Creative Control kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Oh, okay. Well, that's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. And when I come back, I'm going to be talking about the real big movie of the weekend, Batman v Superman, Dawn of Justice. Batman.
There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kaikman Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited.
Kevin Carr returning to the movie review world. Duke it out with two of the biggest superheroes of all time. Batman v. Superman. That's actually the name of it. It's Batman v. Superman. When I saw it in a screening, that a little intro by Zack Snyder. And that's what he called it. This has had a long and rocky road of development. Not just for a Batman versus Superman movie, but for a Superman movie. And it's not been a very kind journey. You go back to the old black and whites. You know, you go back to the 50s. And I think the 40s, they had a serial which starred Kirk Allen as Superman, which was actually a quite a fun little serial. I mean, it was a 1940s Saturday morning serial, so it's as corny and cheesy as the Batman serials from the same era. But he did one, and then you had Superman versus the Mole Men, which is the first one with George Reeves, but it's sort of iconic, and it's goofy in the 1950s way. And then, of course, they did a TV show with George Reeves. And Richard Donner made Superman the movie back in 1978, which was a hit, a huge hit, a great movie, and even holds up today. Now, everyone will say Donner's cut of Superman 2 is better than the original. It's not, because it's incomplete. I think if he was able to finish the movie the way he wanted it to be, it probably would have ended up being a better movie. But Richard Lester took over, and so you had Superman 2, and then Superman 3 was getting goofy, and Superman 4 is a travesty, and you had Supergirl thrown in the mix. And then it went into this development quagmire for decades, where they're going to have Nicolas Cage play in Superman Lives, and they played around with that for a while, and it went through so much development, and people got paid, and then Brett Ratner was going to direct it, and finally they got Bryan Singer to do Superman Returns. But that came with like a $300-some million price tag, because every time somebody got paid, that all went into that budget. So Superman Returns was never going to make back its budget, and then that fell apart, and Man of Steel came out, and Man of Steel was so polarizing of a movie. It's always been a rocky road, whereas Batman has had bad movies, don't get me wrong, but all of them have been successes in some sort of way. I mean, the original Batman serial was a success. The 1960s Batman, as corny and as campy as it was a success. Michael Keaton as Batman in 1989 in Tim Burton's movie, that and the sequel were big movies, and even the third one was a big movie, and it finally petered out at the end. And then, of course, you have the Nolan movie. So Batman has actually done very well in cinemas, so it seems like they're going to pair up well. And it's funny, my aunt, who's a comic book fan from the 50s and 60s, she made a comment to me on Facebook. She said, well, Batman and Superman don't fight. And I'm like, well, they don't fight in the traditional way. But once John Byrne revamped Superman back in 1986, he made their relationship much more contentious. They weren't walking around calling each other old chum and playing pranks on each other, goofing off and having dinner and playing cards together. They have very different methods, and that has sort of defined the modern Superman and Batman. So Batman versus Superman is a very logical step. And when they announced it as a Batman versus Superman movie, I was very excited. I'm like, oh, cool. I kind of want to see this. Where I started to get worried is when they started saying, oh yeah, but it's also going to launch into the Justice League, and they're going to put in Wonder Woman and Aquaman, and it was going to be a Man of Steel sequel, but that's going to be kind of more of a Batman movie, and it's going to be our launching pad for our own version of the Avengers. And it just got more and more away from just a good, solid, single concept film. And I was worried about the casting, Gal Gadot, and everyone else was worried about Ben Affleck as Batman. I wasn't necessarily. People were worried about Jesse Eisenberg as Luthor. The trailers were iffy, and I think they over-marketed it at times. But finally, we've got the movie. And let's talk about that here. Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. I'm talking about Batman v Superman Dawn of Justice. In the aftermath of General Zod's attack on Metropolis, Gotham City's Caped Crusader goes to war with Superman for fear of another alien invasion.
He has the power to wipe out the entire human race.
If we believe there's even a 1% chance that he is our enemy, we have to take it as an absolute certainty.
The greatest gladiator match in the history of the world. God versus man. Day versus night.
You're psychotic.
That is a three-syllable word for any thought too big for little minds.
I've known a few women like you.
Oh, I don't think you've ever known a woman like me.
For all of my worries, which seem to mirror a lot of other people's worries, I have to say I enjoyed the heck out of Batman vs. Superman. I thought it was a really well-done movie. It's not perfect. Don't get me wrong. It's not perfect. And it's not the best superhero movie that's been made. But it certainly is the best Superman movie that's been made since Richard Donner's first film. Now, yeah, I mean, it's not hard to top Superman IV, The Quest for Peace, but it was way better than Superman Returns, and it was better than Man of Steel for a couple reasons. One of the things is they actually bothered to retcon some things. For example, in this movie, Gotham is just like across the bay. Quite literally, they're standing in Metropolis looking over a body of water, and you can see Gotham, which doesn't fit with the Man of Steel movie because with all the stuff that was happening in Metropolis, they never showed Gotham falling to its knees because of this giant world engine that was going on and the fallout and the explosions. And they went from Kansas to Metropolis, but how do they miss Gotham in the process? But that's just because they didn't know that they were going to do this when they did the first movie. But they do retcon Superman's power. He actually gets his power from the sun in this movie. They make a point to show that, as opposed to Man of Steel, where he gets his power from the atmosphere somehow, which never made sense at all. I was happy to see that because Superman's always gotten his power from the yellow sun, at least from the Silver Age on. That's how the way it's worked. But was it too crowded? Actually, I don't think it was. It manages to be both a Batman movie and a Superman movie at the same time. Now, it's probably more of a Batman movie because there's a little bit more for Batman to do. And they actually have Batman do what Batman was originally meant to do, not just punch people out and use gadgets, but he's a great detective, and they have him doing detective work. And Alfred's, of course, helping him out, which, by the way, Jeremy Irons as Alfred is pretty brilliant as well. And it works. I mean, it's not a whimsical movie, but I don't think it takes itself too seriously all the time, although it does. It's heavy, dark, and brooding, don't get me wrong. But I thought Ben Affleck did a fine job as Batman, and I think he gets the bulk of the movie. Now, there's far too many dream sequences in this that could have been cut down. But that's just me with dream sequences. I think they're generally worthless in movies. But even Superman's part, though, Superman is essential to the film. Why it works, in my sense, as a Batman versus Superman movie is because if you remove either of these heroes, you don't have a movie. It wouldn't make any sense. Now, it is setting up the Justice League, and of course, you do have Gal Gadot as Wonder Woman, and she's actually pretty good in the movie, mainly because she doesn't have very many lines. I mean, let's face it, Gal Gadot is not a good actress. She can't deliver dialogue worth anything. But she doesn't have very many lines, kind of like Keanu Reeves in The Matrix, and so that works. I just hope that she takes some acting lessons before she completes Wonder Woman, which is coming out next year. Because she's cool in the movie and she's got one heck of a musical theme, which is kind of, actually, I think it's a better musical theme, for her than it is for Batman or Superman. But she doesn't steal the show. And people are like, oh, she's going to steal the, she doesn't steal the show. And it's not what everyone's talking about. Most people are talking about Ben Affleck. Whenever I hear somebody talk about this one, I'm asked how Ben Affleck did. The only real problem I had with it, there's two things. One of them's really only to do with the movie itself, and that's Jesse Eisenberg as Lex Luthor. He did not do a good Lex Luthor. He basically played Mark Zuckerberg on speed. I mean, it's okay for a crazy billionaire scientist, but it's not Lex Luthor. They botched that. Now, the only other problem I had is that a lot of it's spoiled in the advertising. The reveal of Wonder Woman is in quite a few ads. And if that were not shown in the ads, that would have gotten cheers and a standing ovation from my audience. But everyone knew it was coming, so it loses its impact. If there's anything that's going to work against this movie, it's the fact that it's overmarketed. There's very few surprises in it, because whatever's not in the advertising, you can pretty much guess is going to happen. But still, overall, this is one heck of a fun movie, and I thought it was a fine launching pad into the Justice League and the DC Cinematic Universe. So I'm going to have to say Batman vs. Superman, Dawn of Justice, rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
That's it for this segment. I'm going to come back and review some smaller films like the 17th Annual Animation Show of Shows, Embrace of the Serpent, and Baskin, plus box office and the Home Cinema Roundup. Elizabeth Stokes' new romance novel, Five Nights in Vegas, is about meeting, getting married, and falling in love, in that order. Lexi Frost is a cocktail waitress in a Las Vegas casino. Nate Zimmerman is a marketing executive from back east. After a chance meeting on Nate's business trip, they wake up to discover they got married at an all-night wedding chapel. During their whirlwind attempt to undo their mistake, Lexi and Nate discover they might just be made for each other after all. Five Nights in Vegas by Elizabeth Stokes is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Car with Fat Guys at the Movies. Now that I've kind of talked your ear off about Batman v Superman, Dawn of Justice, let's talk about a couple other movies that are opening or are open or rolling out this weekend. And a lot of them are in limited release. Sometimes you can get these on demand. Now, I don't have any full trailers for any of these simply because, well, the animation one, there's almost no dialogue in it. And so there's no words in the trailer, so it'd just be music. That doesn't give you any sense. And then Embrace of the Serpent is in Spanish. So right off the bat, you've got the 17th Annual Animation Show of Shows. And this is 11 short films from around the world, and they're highlighted in here. Now, some of these we've seen before, two of them in particular, which was We Can't Live Without Cosmos and World of Tomorrow, both of which were nominated for the Academy Award for Animated Short Films. And I personally, my favorite of all the ones that were nominated was World of Tomorrow. I thought was fascinating and beautiful and charming and wonderful. And the reason I love these animated short films is because, well, I mean, some of these take years to put together. And there's one that's a stop motion parable tale, something that maybe Dr. Seuss would have written in a different life about a kid who walks around on stilts. They have just some very out of the box thinking. And it's not just about messages. It's not just about talking about one specific emotion. You get a wide range of topics in this. I think there are 11 short films in the bunch. Four of them get background, like a little like 3 or 4 minute documentary after it that explains where it came from and the inspirations for it. So I love animation. I've always loved animation. And the annual Animation Show of Shows is a great way to spotlight a concentration of animation all in one place. Totally worth checking out. That one totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
Yay! Let's talk about Embrace of the Serpent. It's a Colombian movie, and it was entered in as an Academy Award for Best Foreign Language Film. And it's told in two time periods with the same native guy, and it takes place in the rainforest. This guy becomes a guide to a man 20, 30 years ago, who's sick and needed to be cured. And he's trying to find this rare plant that has healing powers. And so he hires his guide to help him go find it. It tells his story and his journey to get there and the people and the places that he runs into along the way. Then it also takes a separate story a couple decades down the road where a person's trying to trace this guy's path to find this plant. And he ends up hiring the same guide. And it's sort of how things have changed over the decades and the seeds that were planted when they were younger, what they grew into. And it's a very introspective film. It's worth checking out. It's in black and white, and it's very unique. But if you want something that thinks a bit outside of the box, you can check this one out. Embrace of the Serpent kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
Let's talk about Baskin. This is a Turkish movie. It's a horror movie, very grisly. And it takes place all kind of in this one night in sort of the middle of nowhere. A small group of Turkish police find themselves tormented by a mysterious cult. Nope. Okay, we'll stop playing that right now. This is an extremely violent and disturbing movie. But what is respectable about it is it doesn't delve into playing chicken with other movies by being as offensive as possible. There was a time 5, 6, 7 years ago where filmmakers were just trying to come up with the most extreme, goriest, grisliest, most offensive, violent scenes ever. And that's how you ended up with movies like Human Centipede and a Serbian film, which I actually quite liked, but still a Serbian film. Serbian film basically said, okay, we're going to do the worst thing that you possibly can in a movie. No one's going to be able to top this. And there became this one-upmanship in independent and oftentimes foreign horror cinema to become more extreme. You know, movies like Martyrs and Inside and these movies that were just violent and bloody and disturbing and not anything at all that you would see at a normal theater. Baskin tries to do something a little bit different. It's violent and bloody, don't get me wrong, but it takes a while to get there. It was funny because I saw it at a press screening and they served lunch before it. And I had my lunch and I was running late, so I took it into the theater with me. And I'm quickly trying to eat because I'm like, I don't know when it's going to get disgusting, so I'm going to eat my lunch as quick as possible. But I had plenty of time to eat my lunch before it got violent and bloody. But it's more disturbing. It's not even like overtly in-your-face violent as much as it is just, it has this whole section that's very disturbing and twisted and weird, and it's very surreal. But for the horror fan, you're going to want to see it because it's extreme and powerful, and boy, is it in your face. So I'm going to say Baskin kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the box office. Was I correct? Last week I said Zootopia was going to win with $38 million. I was very close. It came in with $37 million, and it has now made over $200 million in the theaters domestically. In second place was the Divergent series Allegiant with only $29 million. That represents a drop of 40-some percent from the opening weekend of the last film. The last two films, the first two films, made over $50 million their opening weekends, and this thing didn't even muster in $30 million. I mean, we're getting shades of Battleship here, where people are just staying away from this movie in droves. I think it's lost its audience. I think it's lost everyone but its very core fans. This is bad for Summit. This is bad for Lionsgate. This is not a good opening. Miracles from Heaven made just under $15 million, and that's a much more respectable opening considering Miracles from Heaven cost only $13 million to make. It's going to leg its way to some pretty decent numbers, you know, $50 to $60 million, most likely taking advantage of the Easter holiday. And 10 Cloverfield Lane came in next. It's the only thing that made over $10 million. Deadpool still kicking. $340 million domestic, which is a huge number. And Batman versus Superman may not make that. We'll see. Speaking of Batman versus Superman, what's it going to make this weekend? Conventional wisdom saying somewhere between $160 and $180 million. It's possible. I mean, it's kind of uncharted territory because we have big numbers for March. I mean, the Hunger Games, the original Hunger Games made $158 million, I think, its opening weekend. And that was in March. But that was an unheard of phenomenon. Big, huge, 100 million plus openings in March, there's not a whole lot of data on that. You're talking summer movie season for this sort of thing, and I don't know if you can treat it exactly the same. I mean, yeah, it's going to be spring break for a lot of kids, but I think with the marketing and the expectations, you can't just say Batman plus Superman is going to equal the Dark Knight box office plus the Man of Steel box office. You're going to get an amalgamation of them both. And those movies came out in June and July. So you may also have people waiting to see how it is. They may wait. They may not be eager to see it at first, which will give it longer legs, but you won't get that big, huge front-loaded opening weekend. I'm going to safely say $150 million for Batman versus Superman. Dawn of Justice, the biggest problem is that Warner Brothers is betting the farm on this thing. This has to do $160 to $180 million opening weekend. It has to make $350 million domestic. It has to make $1 billion worldwide to justify its own existence. That is its biggest danger leading up to everything, because they're going to be rolling cameras on Justice League Part 1 next month. Now, when it comes to My Big Fat Greek Wedding 2, I think you're going to get about, I'm going to say $15 million is safe. That's good for counter-programming. If you look back at stuff like Maid of Honor that came out against Iron Man, That's the counter programming number you want. And $15 million is fine for Big Fat Greek Wedding because it's not that expensive of a movie. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll in the world famous home cinema roundup. Speaking of The Hunger Games, that one came out. Part 2 of Mockingjay is now out on DVD and Blu-ray. I rewatched it. It has some decent features, some behind-the-scenes stuff. It has a commentary. It's definitely worth getting for the fan because you can't get a two-disc set. There's also Daddy's Home, which was a surprise hit over Christmas. That is available. And then just a look back at Jesus of Nazareth. This came out a couple weeks ago on Blu-ray for the first time, but it's Easter weekend. Why not talk about it? This is a good look back at what TV miniseries used to be. Now it's, of course, very low rent compared to something like Ben-Hur. It doesn't have the big special effects, but it almost too deliberately tries to tell the stories that are in the Gospels. And the guy who plays Jesus is non-dynamic. I mean, he looks really, he's a good looking guy with blue eyes, but you run into the same problems that the Christ character is very hard to play, but it has a great cast and it's worth checking out for that reason to see people, you know, like Michael York, you know, these younger actors who are older now, Ian McShane, you got, you know, Olivia Hussey playing Mary, Mother of Jesus. You've got Anne Bancroft playing Mary Magdalene. It's a great cast and it's worth seeing sort of for those notable film actors who went to television for a miniseries. That's it for the show. Happy Easter, everybody. Next week, I'm going to be talking about Collide, God's Not Dead 2, I Saw the Light, and Everybody Wants Some. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.